Thanks, Rich. Can everybody hear me well? Okay. I'm Greg. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Thanks, Richie, for calling up the other day and asking me to step up. very grateful to this fellowship and the AA members. There was a time where I couldn't stop drinking, and I had gotten out of my first rehab. And before that, there was lots of scenes where I was drinking and throwing up the next day, or driving the car up the one-way street the wrong way. I remember quickly going, drinking a case of beer with the returnable bottles, and we went back to the distributor with the empties, and we got a new case, and it was snowing out, and it was like 2 inches of snow and sleet, and we spun around in the snow when the cops came after us. I'm sitting in the back seat, and my friend Joe in the passenger seat's got the whole new case, and he's screaming at the cop, "We didn't drink any of them! They're all here! We didn't drink any of them!" And the cop is like, "What the hell is wrong with this guy?" And we drank 24 bottles like a half hour earlier, But we had the whole full case, so he's like, just yelling at the cop, and it's like, "Joe, calm down," So crazy things like that. And I remember going out. I was working in a restaurant in the 80s, and they said, "Can you do the?" I was already booked for 9 o'clock in the morning to 6 for Friday. So Thursday night, it was a bar down in Brooklyn called Captain Walters. I don't even know if it's still there, but their big night was Thursday nights. So they asked me, "Can you do Thursday night too?" So I said, "All right, I'll do it." So it went from 6 to 1 in the morning. Now, I got to get up at 9, but everybody's going to Captain Walters. So what happens is I go there, and I close out the bar. I get home like 4:45 in the morning, and I got to get up at like 8:30. I had a mile to go to work to walk. And I was in my 20s, and I felt like death. I just felt like death. I was so bombed. And when I got home, and it was like 3.5 hours of sleep, and the phone's ringing, "Greg, where are you?" "I'm coming." And got down there. And these things are over and over and over again. So let's get to it. We're going to start on page XXVI. All right? It's the doctor's opinion. Okay? Second paragraph. "The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer." The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. With our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while there, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he suggested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients. Here, with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, their community spirit, is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So that section, a page and a half, really rung true with me. Talks about the community spirit and the camaraderie that, you know, new addicts, you know, have, and alcoholic addicts have with each other. You know, that the therapeutic value of one alcoholic helping another, you know, they say is without parallel. So, you know, I can relate to that. He says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy. You know, I'm allergic to alcohol. Whenever I drink, I break out in handcuffs, right? and you hear that all the time. You know, I was arrested 3 times in Brooklyn, 3 times in New York. I'm not sure if they were all in Brooklyn, but 3 times and 3 times in New Jersey. I moved out here about 25 years ago. So, you know I had run-ins with the law, and a couple of times I was arrested, and it was, you know, short stays. A couple of them it was longer, you know, but and very expensive. So, you know, been to a lot of institutions, but I'm grateful to this fellowship. As I said before, I'm grateful to our my predecessors, sponsors, sponsees, my network, my my recovery, you know, spans 2 states, 3 decades. I 30 years ago, last Monday, February 6th, I think that was last Monday, was when I went to my first rehab. So, you know, it was a long journey. And my first 2 years, from 93 to the end of 94, I couldn't stop drinking. And I kept trying and trying, and the disease got the better of me. So, when I came out of my first rehab, you know, I was using dry goods also, so I was kind of, you know, substituting, you know, and I said, I'm not going to use that stuff. I'll just drink and smoke pot, you know, and I maybe put together 100 days in that first year at 93, and then by 94, SHIT show. I don't know if you can curse it here, but anyway, so, so before coming into recovery, I was an individual whose life and existence was one of depravity. It revolved around debauchery and moral turpitude. I was a douchebag, to put it simply. You know, if I'd known Rich, would have been a douchebag to him. If I'd known Kurt, I would have been a douchebag, or Kevin, I would have been a douchebag to you too. I would have been a douchebag to anybody who ran into me. You know, I was a douche. Did I say I was a douchebag?
Yes.
Let's have a contest. Who can say douchebag the most here today? Anyway, so that's what I was. And you know, to the most important person that the person I treated the worst was myself. Because the higher I got on the alcohol, the lower I felt. You know, I had clinical depression. I was, just very sad. You know, I would go into a supermarket, my eyes would glaze over, and I was like, couldn't look people in the face, you know. And, you know, I just, you know, it was from drinking so much and using other substances. So, you know, but I came out of my first rehab in 93, February 93. In March, I was in the halfway house in Lower Manhattan and with Chris Farley from Saturday Night Live. And he was great. And he was before he did his movie. So I that month before I got into that rehab, that halfway house, I was 130 pounds. I'm 6'1", and I'm about 190. So it was 60 pounds ago. Now I'm worried about putting on weight, you know. But, I was so skinny. They said, Greg, what you do with the chicken? I said, what chicken? They said, the chicken you got those legs from. So it was like two pretzel sticks. So, but I put on a pound a day, and I went into the halfway house, and I started drinking in there. And then they said, you know, after about 3.5 weeks, and they said, "Oh, you got to go," you know, because everybody at my job was drinking and everybody was, you know, using other stuff. And I was like, you know, that other stuff, that's the stuff that's killing me. So who the hell are these people to tell me I can't drink, you know? So I had to do a lot of research in the field. And I got the same results, you know, half steps avail us nothing, right? So let's move on to page 8. We'll start at the second paragraph, trembling. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. Then came the insidiousness, insanity of that first drink, and on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to that certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, usefulness in a way of life, in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin before near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked me if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember him coming, his coming to New York, and that in that condition I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner, and then I would drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. He had what had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into this fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smiling. He said, "I've got religion." I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant, because my gin would last longer than his preaching. And we'll finish out this. But he did no ranting. In fact, in a matter of fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass this experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. And, you know, I love that section because, you know, he starts off talking about the insanity, and then by the end of the page, he's talking about hope. And, hope is such a, you know, antidote to insanity. And, I always think of step two when we think of insanity and hope and faith, you know. But, you know, we come in here to, you know, he says, the end, I was to know happy, this fourth dimension he talks about in the first paragraph on page 8, trembling paragraph. He says, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness. And that, you know, that's what we all want, you know, because before, you know, I came here, I was like, I was stoic. I wasn't, I was like unemotional. I wasn't able to feel happiness, you know. It was, on a good day, I was stoic. Forget about happiness, you know. It was never going to be a happy day. It was just going to be, you know, an even keel day, but without any kind of exhilaration or, you know, contentment or, you know, real, joy, you know. And, you know, so, you know, we come in to recover to be happy, joyous, and free. And he's talking about that fourth dimension, which I think, you know, I personally think it's the world of spirituality that we get when we start nursing, you know, our spirits back. You know, they say bring the body, the mind will follow. You bring the mind, the spirit starts to come back. And then if you get older, like me and Kurt, we start to go back and take care of our bodies. So it's kind of a circular thing. But, you know, that fourth dimension to me reminds me of, he says, the fourth dimension of existence. And, you know, we come in here with a spiritual bankruptcy, right? And once we stop drinking and we start saving up our sober days, sober days in the bank. You know, we put another sober day in our recovery piggy bank every night. And, you know, lo and behold, we start to feel that positive, you know, balance on our spiritual, sheet, you know. We start to feel better about ourselves, you know. And it reminds me of the early days. You know, this is Bill's story, and it reminds me, you know, how he's got this guy at his house, and you know, I don't think it's Dr. Bob, but maybe it is. I'm not sure. It doesn't give any indication, but you know, he sees a glimmer of this kind of thing where two people got together and there was a synthesis of hope, you know, that comes out of the two of them. You know, there's a holistic thing that some of the parts, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. One person can't get sober on his own, but when you put two of them together, throw in a coffee pot, you know, you got an AA meeting, right? So, you know, there was something going on there, therapeutic value of one alcoholic helping another. You know, for me, this disease, you know, is cunning, baffling, powerful, right? We've heard that before. It's incurable, fatal, and progressive. It's insidious. It tells me I don't have a drinking problem. I can go out, you know. In fact, about 10 days ago, I had a drinking dream. I was in a bar, and my wife is sitting at a table, and I get up at the table, and I go over to see these friends, and they're from another bar, and I don't even recognize this bar. The only part of the bar that I recognize is the railing, and it's like a mahogany, and I'm like, wow, that's just the way I remember it, you know. And I don't recognize any other part of the bar, and the guy's offering me a drink, and I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know, you can give me beer, or you can give me, and you know, somehow a Presbyterian came into my mind. I never had a Presbyterian. My father used to drink them. I don't know what they were, ginger ale and rye or something. And so he reaches behind the bar, and there's one already made, and he brings it over to me. I said, I don't want that. That's been there, you know. So then somebody else comes in, and another guy I knew, and, you know, it was just a crazy dream, you know. I haven't had a drink since 1994, and yet out of the blue comes this dream. And, you know, a little bit of it is people-pleasing, you know. I think, you know, we say, oh, yeah, I'll have a drink, because, you know, you're in the bar. You got to have a drink, right? You know, so this is... And it's a disease telling me I don't have a disease. That, you know, just have one because you're expected to, you know. And so, you know, I kept coming around. And they told me, five keeps. They told me, keep coming back, right? You know, I met a guy today. I was at another AA meeting, the first aid squad in Edison. And everybody who was new or under 30 days or, you know, under 90 days, they put up their hand. And this guy didn't. And when I went over to see him, he told me he relapsed yesterday, and he got one day back. And I said, why did you drink? And he said, I don't know why. I said, you call your sponsor. But, you know, I said, just listen, you didn't get sick in 30, 40, 50 days. I think he had around 50 days. And I said, you're not going to get, you know, you got to be realistic about it. We made ourselves sick over decades, you know, and it takes a long time. We don't get cured overnight. But, you know, they told me, keep coming back. There's no shame in relapse. The shame is if I don't keep coming back. Because I put my name, my hand up and said, I'm Greg and I'm an alcoholic. It becomes what I'm going to do about it. Not that relapse is okay, but, you know, it's very important to keep coming back. So they told me, keep coming back. They told me, keep the focus on myself. They told me, keep it green. You know, remember the last time you used how bad it was. You know, they told me, keep it simple. And they told me, keep it in today. Don't use today. That's the bedrock of my recovery. I don't use today. Four words, you know. We don't use today. So let's go on to page 10. Third paragraph, actually. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise, immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. So, you know, I had 12 years of Catholic education, and I came in, and there was a Jewish guy upstairs, and he was in AA, and I went to the other AA and my other fellowship. I also belong to NA, Narcotics Anonymous. So, you know, so I said to him, how do you pray? And his name was Mike S. I said, Mike, how do you pray? And you know, I was a choir boy. You know, I did a lot in the church, you know. And he says, Greg, just do the two-part prayer. You know, say, thank you, God, for not letting me drink yesterday. Two, help me stay sober today. And I said, oh, that's good. I like that. Simple. Praying in gratitude and humility. I'm thanking God for not letting me drink yesterday and saying, please help me stay sober today. So humility is asking for help. So, you know, but a lot of us come in here and we're just like Bill in this story. He didn't want to hear about God. You know, we're so divorced from God and anything of the spiritual, you know, plane that... you know, like he says, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. And, you know, it's important to believe in God. God helps those who help themselves, you know. In fact, 5 of our 12 steps mention God or him, you know. Higher power in the second step, third step, made a decision to turn our will over to God. The fifth step, the fifth step. Seventh step, the tenth, fifth step, the seventh step, the 11th step, and probably, yeah, I probably mentioned 5 right there. So anyway, this is a disease of the body, mind, and spirit, and the solution is spiritual, right? So if I want to get spiritual, you know, I don't want to be concerned about material things, and I want to be concerned about spiritual things. And what are spiritual things? Principles like honesty, acceptance, surrender, faith, hope, open-mindedness, willingness, trust, forgiveness, you know, selflessness. And, you know, a lot of the principles, the spiritual principles in the big book come directly from the good book, and we owe a debt of gratitude. We also owe a debt of gratitude to the Oxford group, which had the original 6 steps. But, you know, when we get to selflessness, right? That's like the golden rule, right? Do unto others like you like them to do to you, right? So, you know, so that's directly from the good book. So, and I'm not a Bible thumper at all, but, you know, and I don't do organized religion, but I do pray every day. And it's important to pray because, you know, we are what we pay attention to, you know. And if, you know, I pay attention to my recovery and I pay attention to developing a relationship with God, I'll have a relationship. I remember hearing a quote that said, in order to believe in the existence of God, not only must I yearn for God's existence, I have to act as if God really does exist. And in order to act as if, how do I do that? Through prayer. I'm making the clasp of my hands together. Anyway, so I usually pray in the morning. I make my bed and I pray. You know, some people pray when they're brushing their teeth or driving a car or, you know, making their first cup of coffee. Me, I like to do it when I'm making my bed. So, and sometimes I'll say a different prayer. I'll say, there's a third step prayer in here. But there's another one I know, take my will and my life, guide me in my recovery and show me how to live. And I'll say that to God. And I'll say, thank you for not letting me use yesterday, because I gotta have some gratitude in my prayer, not just humility, not just asking for help. So, at this point in Bill's story, I think there's a clear contradiction. He wants to believe in a higher power and God, yet he's intolerant. And alcoholics have intolerance towards spiritual principles. But that's the only thing that'll defeat us, you know. If we don't want to be honest, we can't say that I'm an alcoholic, I have a problem with alcoholism, right? So, you know, if we're going to do step work and we're going to lie when we answer the questions, you know, basically lying's a form of dishonesty, right? If I go out and I drink and then I come to a meeting and I don't tell anybody, you know, I'm being dishonest, right? I'm copping short on my sobriety time. And, you know, so, you know, but we can't lie. We can lie to other people. We can't lie to ourselves. And, you know, everybody knows, you know, and it catches up with us. So prayer is indispensable to recovery, and getting spiritually centered prayer is essential to incorporating and inculcating spiritual principles, you know. So recovery at once is a learning and a teaching process. We can't graft new ideas onto a closed mind. So, in a way, we're teaching ourselves, but we have our predecessors teaching us, right? And, we have to be open-minded and willing to learn, because, you know, there's a lot of things. You know, listen, I know there's millions of books out there, and I'm probably going to read like 1/10 of 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%, you know, by the time I die. And there's going to be tons of stuff out there that I don't know when I die. But I needed to know this stuff. I needed to know this book. And I needed to know that, you know, I had a problem and a sickness, and, you know, and I can't do it on my own. And there are people who've got a lot more experience, a lot more knowledge about it. And I needed to arm myself with these spiritual principles. And, and learning is sort of, like, you know, it's a job, you know. When I come into recovery, I got to act like I'm a student, and I'm going to sit in the front row. But I'm also I have to be vigilant, you know, like a night watchman. He stands vigil, right? Because, you know, this disease wants to come up from behind me like I'm a little fly with a roll of newspaper, rolled up newspaper, and swat me, right? Now, the night watchman, he's got some tools. He's got, like, the handcuffs. He's got the mace. He's got the whistle. He's got the sidearm, the gun. He's got a walkie-talkie, and he used some of these weapons. Oh, we have people in NA. We have the phone. We can call people. We can call our sponsor. We can call our network. We can pray. We can do step work at home. We can do all these different things. So we have some tools that we can use, and using them is a learning process. And trying to broaden our spiritual horizons is going to go a long way to defeating a disease of the body, mind, and spirit, you know. And so I guess that it's disease of the body, mind, and spirit. Solution is spiritual. So, okay, so let's go on to the page 25. It says, there is a solution. Almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living in it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Yeah, so, you know, this gets back to what I was saying. The solution is spiritual. There is a solution, and, we can't think our way. You know, we have to act our way into recovery. I used to go to a lot of meetings in Brooklyn. I used to say, let your sneakers do your thinking, right? You know, so because once I just like talk myself into doing things my way, I'm basically abandoning spiritual principles. I'm saying, I know what's best for Greg. I know that I don't need to go to a meeting tonight. I don't need to call my sponsor. I don't need to do any of those things. And that's when I start doing my own thinking. And when I start taking some suggestions, what do they say? Suggestions are subtle demands, right? And they say, Greg, call me when you don't feel like using. So you'll be able to call me when you do feel like using, right? One of my sponsors told me that, my second to last sponsor, Kurt's my sponsor, by the way, but I had like five or six sponsors, and I had three in Brooklyn and three here, and the sixth one said, Greg, you call me when you don't feel like using, so you'll be able to call me when you do feel like using. And I said, that's great. And from that, I said, share at meetings when you don't feel like drinking, so you'll be able to share and rat on your disease when you do feel like drinking. So, this is a corresponding love that for oneself that goes up, that just increases as we don't use. Because, there's a saying I heard when I moved to New Jersey. I was at a meeting and this lady, Colleen, she shared something really, really profound. She said, the greatest manifestation of self-hatred is using. So if I go out and drink, I get to hate Greg, you see? So if I've been using for decades, I've been displaying self-hatred for Greg for decades, So, the more I love the disease, the less I love Greg. It's an inverse proportion. When I stop drinking, I start loving Greg. And so what happens is I can love others. I can't love anyone else if I don't love myself. So once I put down the booze and stop drinking, I stop hating myself. And we don't even know it, But our predecessors that are here before us, they know it. They know it. And that's why, most important persons in the rooms are the ones that are just coming back and the ones that are struggling not to use and don't feel all that great about themselves. I mean, there's never a time where I got so blitz drunk and was throwing up and said, wow, that was great, I can't wait to do that again, or had this massive hangover, felt like I had a virus, and I was like, couldn't even walk. And that's a symptom of self-hatred, because the higher the booze took me, the lower it brought me, right? And but in AA, we'll love you until you learn to love yourself. And then, we pay it forward. So, so let's go on. We're going to jump ahead to page 58. And second paragraph. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Now, that's a double entendre. It's a double meaning. You want to take some action, but you also want to work the steps, right? So, I see you smiling.
That's good.
So we take certain steps, and you know, if I'm not working on my recovery, I'm working on my relapse, you see? So, you know, recently I decided to figure out if there are 60 minutes in an hour and it's 24 hours in a day, there's 1,440 minutes in a day, and if I go to a meeting for 60 minutes, I'm only using 4% of my day on my recovery. And newcomers need to do a lot more than that, you know? I mean, there's a lot of suggestions that we say, make 90 meetings a day, call your sponsor, call your network, you know, do some step work at home. And that 4% goes up if I'm sitting at my kitchen table answering questions. It's so important to do step work at home and do things at home. Call your sponsor, pray, you know, read the Living Sober, read the meditation, do a Zoom meeting, call a newcomer. You know, an addict or an alcoholic with 2 days can help one with 1 day, you know. And, you know, and it's very important to help somebody else. If you know, when we were earlier reading that section where the guy came over Bill's house and he said him and another guy got together and they were able to do something that gave them some you know, therapeutic synergy. They couldn't do by themselves, but together they were feeding off of themselves, their recovery, each other's recovery, you're building recovery. So if you decided what we want, what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. That part reminded me when I was in my first rehab. Two guys came in, and they reminded me of how people at work were talking about starting families, having kids, buying a house, you know, all these different things that people do when they get married and they're not stuck in the on the rat wheel of using and recovering and using and recovering and, you know, pensions and, you know, working on their house, Little League. And I wasn't doing any of that. It was like year in and year out. And these two guys came up and they sat on the stage in my rehab and we had a whole room full of people and they said, I got married, I got two kids, I got a nice picket fence, a swimming pool in the backyard, I'm really enjoying life, and, you know, I mow the grass, and, you know, I got a mortgage, but it's great, I'm sober 7 years, and at the end he said, if you want what I have, do what I've done, and get what I've got. And that sounds just like it says here, if you've decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, you know, so I really said, wow, I really want what they got, you know. If you want what I have, do what I've done and get what I've got. So, you know, but I was pretty sick. I had, you know, had a lot of research in the field to go. And you know, my first 2 years from February 6, 93 to the end of 94, and I didn't work any steps at all. I was like, what the F? I mean, what a jackass. 10 years later, I look back and I said, hee-haw, this guy's, I was a jackass. I was coming to a 12-step fellowship and I wasn't working any of the 12 steps. I was just going to meetings. You know, my recovery's like an iceberg. The little part above the water, that's going to meetings. Most of my recovery iceberg is below the surface. It's outside the meetings. It's calling my sponsor, calling my sponsee brothers, or my sponsees, or you know, Kurt was sponsoring some nine or ten other people, and talking to them, networking at meetings, calling people on the phone, doing step work at kitchen tables. I did about four or five. In fact, the last kitchen table was at Kurt's house down at his little vacation nest down in St. Martin. And so I was halfway through 12 and I finished 12, and his sponsee group was up to step 10 when I joined him, and I was finished with step 10 and was on the shelf waiting. So I finished step 12 down there. And you know, previously, you know, I had lived in an apartment in Brooklyn, and you know, did a lot of step work there, and so you know, but you know, step work is so useful. So where are we? All right. So page 60. Many of us exclaimed top first paragraph. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Now, you just read the 12 steps. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles that we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas: that we were alcoholic, we could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that God could and would if he was sought. Being convinced we were at step three, which is what we decided to, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that? Just what do we do? First requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the plays in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest. But as with humans, most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. So, yeah, you know, this is almost a lead-up into step four, you know, where there's good and bad in both of us. There's the positive inventory, negative inventory. But at the end, he says he's always trying to run the whole show. And, you know, it's that control freak nature that we all have. Because, you know, I think I got this from Oprah. She said, well, a lot of us become control freaks because early in our lives, or sometime in our lives, especially behind our using, things were out of control. And now we get sober, and now we want to control, fix, manage, and control every nuance of our own lives and everybody else's. And so that's what he's saying. And he's also saying, you know, in this chapter, how it works, he's saying that we're trying to turn over our will, not be willful. And step three has faith, but it also has willingness as a key spiritual principle. And it's kind of a paradox because, you know, we want to turn over our will. We don't want to be willful, but we're praying for willingness to not be willful, which is kind of, you know, contradiction, you know, a little bit, you know. So, but, you know, turning over our will is defined as surrender, right? Surrender is defined as, it's like A equals B, so B equals A, right? So I turn over my will, I surrender. I can't force my will on everybody, you know, especially all the time. And surrender is just, it's just a tactical decision to save one's life, right? So we surrender in step one, and then we're kind of like saying, you know what, I don't have to be right all the time, you know, I just have to be happy, you know, when it comes down to being happy and right, choose to be happy, you know. So, you know, surrender is important. You know, in the first step, and here we're seeing it again here, and you know, I don't want to be willful, you know. And a lot of us are willful because, you know, that's that control freak, you know. Like we want to, well, we're not going to drink, so we'll exercise our will in other areas of our lives where we think we can or we should. And sometimes we're doing it for really good reasons, like it talks about being considerate, kind, patient, generous, but other times it's kind of sinister, or egotistical, or self-centered, you know, and vain. So okay, so let's move on to, how much time I got, Richie?
5 minutes.
Okay. Let's move on to the top of page 63, first paragraph. Here is the third step prayer. We are now at step three. Many of us have said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, and that we could that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Yeah. And if anybody hasn't read the full Serenity Prayer, it talks about being happy with him in this world, so that I'll be supremely happy with him in the next. And most of us just know the Serenity Prayer, the one that we say all the time. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage. There's another whole stanza after that, and you can look it up, Google it. Basically, it's about turning over my will. It's really asking for help. It's humility is key. I'm beseeching, when we pray, we beseech, we ask for help, okay. Then we move on to step four. Step four, we have the positive, negative inventory. On page 64, it talks about having inventory in stock and some of our personalities, we have some really lousy parts of our personality we don't want. That's the stuff that's unsellable. It's breakage, right? We throw that stuff away and at least we try. And, the 12 by 12, the AA 12 by 12 talks about the seven deadly sins, pride, anger, greed, gluttony, lust, envy, sloth. I usually add resentment, fear, and self-hatred to that, So these things are unsellable items. And I'll read this section and then I'll try to wrap it up real quick. So, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four, business, which takes no regular inventory, usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damage or unsellable goods, get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. So, we have a positive and negative inventory and, with a business and with ourselves. And, when we take our inventory, we basically are saying, I was angry or I have a problem with anger or I have greed or lust or ego. And I want to get rid of those things. I want to be less of those things. And I want to substitute the opposite spiritual principle. So, a lot of these things some people have before they become alcoholic, and then some of them get, are new manifestations, new personality problems that they acquired behind their drinking. And I drank. And I used and I got clean and sober and I turned it around and then I drank and I used and then I turned it around and I can use anything, any of those seven deadly sins as a substitution. In fact, I was addicted to the hokey pokey, but I turned myself around. That was a little joke. Anyway, so let's move on to. To page 66.
And it,
66, yes. At the top of the page, it says to conclude that others were wrong was far from, was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes a deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. to the precise extent that we commit these, we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal, for when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. So, John F. Kennedy said, to those who much has been given, much is to be expected, right? So, he got that from Mark, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the second writer. And we've been given a great gift here, right? And we don't want to be resentful in our lives. We want to say, what right do I have to be a sourpuss and a sad sack and a wet blanket and go around pouting and saying, life sucks. It's so and so's fault. My boss fired me, and I wasn't willing to own up to my, and carry a load of resentment, and it's poisonous. So one of the ways we counteract that is being grateful, and paying it forward. Let's see. Let's move over to page 76. Over here, they talk about top of page 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we ready now to let God remove us from all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. And so basically, in 5, 6, and 7, there's no more positive, negative, and it's all negative, right? It's exact nature of our wrongs, character defects and shortcomings, right? So basically, this is a real demolition process, and a leveling of where we are, and it's very useful because we end up getting this catharsis, this healing process, by looking at ourselves and looking at ourselves warts and all, and quite often, some of it's ugly, when we come in here, we change and we start being a little bit more generous, a lot more generous and a lot more caring. And so I'll finish this up real quickly. Page 567 is an area about spiritual experience, right? The last part of the book, and it talks about getting spiritual. It says the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. What he's saying is it's a gradual thing. You know what I mean? We didn't get sick overnight. We're not going to get cured overnight. And we have to, work our spirits from being bankrupt and void of any spirituality and any kind of, spiritual people believe in their own betterment, and they want to feel good about themselves. They do feel better about themselves, but when we come in here, we don't feel good about ourselves, We feel like, hopeless, helpless, completely, tore up from the floor up, as they say. So, today we comport ourselves with dignity, honesty, integrity, thanks to our recovery. And I'd like to say, stepless people lead harmful lives, right? So, we get spiritual principles and a spiritually principled life. We meet spiritual people that believe in helping themselves and improving their lot in life. Recovery and AA makes me want to be a better man. I got that from As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson. he's a sick dude himself. He's got an obsessive compulsive, and he doesn't want to take his medicine or anything. He doesn't want to admit it. He's got problems. But you know what? When he starts taking his medicine and he's in love with Helen Hunt, he says, "You make me want to be a better man." It's the same thing in recovery. So I hope you got something good. Oh, one last thing. God is loving and caring. God is essential. The intersection of organized religion and spiritual recovery is God. God helps those help themselves. So, we have a moral obligation to be happy. And, you know, there's one thing that can preclude me from being happy, and that is drinking. If I go out and drink, I'm not going to feel too happy tomorrow. You know, so when I'm, moral obligation means when I'm being good, I'm being happy. When I'm being happy, I'm being good. If I'm being sad and angry, you know what? Nobody wants to be around me. So thanks for letting me share, and over to you guys.